This is Writer's Voice, compelling conversations with authors who challenge, inspire, and inform. This week on Writer's Voice, two stories of women who refuse to accept the limits placed on them. Journalist Eden Collinsworth tells the extraordinary story of Victoria Woodhull, an audacious 19th century reformer who became the first woman to run for president of the United States. Then novelist Shelley Noble brings us to 1915 New York and the legendary Book Row, where a community of booksellers confronted one of the most powerful censors in American history, Anthony Comstock. Two books, two eras, and a shared theme: women challenging authority and expanding the boundaries of freedom. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station, your favorite podcast app, or at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Victoria Woodhull was one of the most remarkable and controversial figures of the 19th century. Born into poverty with no formal education, she reinvented herself repeatedly, first as a spiritualist, then as a Wall Street stockbroker at a time when women couldn't even own bank accounts, let alone brokerage houses, then as a newspaper publisher, and finally, as the first woman to run for president of the United States. Journalist Eden Collinsworth's biography, The Improbable Victoria Woodhull, brings new attention to this extraordinary figure and examines why Woodhull's story has largely been forgotten, despite the boldness of her achievements. Let's hear my conversation with her now. Eden Collinsworth, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
I love this book. It's really beautifully written, very interestingly written as well, The Improbable Mrs. Woodhull. I would say probably most Americans know nothing about Victoria Woodhull. Mm-hmm. And while I knew about her, my knowledge was extremely sparse. What drew you to her story?
Well, that in and of itself is a story. I mean, I, like you and most Americans, knew nothing of her. And it happened that I learned about her here in London at the British Museum. And so the British Museum at one point housed the British Library before all the books were moved to a very, you know, a larger, more modern space in the 1990s. And it happened that I was invited, I was very flattered, I was invited by the museum to, this was kind of after COVID, when the museum actually was still shut, but I was invited to look at the, and better understand the catalog system in what used to be, you know, the British Library under this vast dome in the middle of the British Museum. And what had happened was during COVID, you know, the museum took advantage of the fact that the public wasn't, you know, allowed in. And there was a librarian there for the duration who started to organize and assemble a catalog system for all of the items left in this space that were not books. And so it was the most remarkable eclectic collection of things. I mean, there was, you know, there were Karl Marx's postcards. You know, he wrote and researched the manifesto from the library there. And there was also, difficult to believe but true, the shell of an incendiary bomb that had come through the roof during the Blitz. And so one of the few things that caught my eye that wasn't actually on the floor being cataloged were these remarkably beautiful kind of blue leather folios, and the spine read Woodhull versus the British Museum. And I asked the librarian who this woman was, or what were the folios, and they turned out to be the transcripts of a suit that went to the Old Bailey, you know, in front of a jury and judge. And it happened that this woman sued the British Museum for libel. And she was an American. This was in the 1890s. And, you know, she just appeared out of nowhere. And it was just unfathomable that somebody, she, by the way, had no, you know, formal education. She was a woman, you know, at a time when women had no agency or voice in any sense. And so there was this woman who appeared from America, who successfully sued the museum, its trustees, and the head librarian. And so I asked the librarian for more information, and she simply didn't have any other than to say in a very kind of accusatory manner, well, yes, that was another American woman, as though somehow I was responsible for and but she didn't know. I said, well, what did she do? What prompted this? And she said, which is very English, she said, I have no idea, but she caused everybody a great deal of inconvenience. So at any rate, I started to snoop around wondering who this woman was. And so that is how I, you know, was introduced to Victoria Woodhill.
And you do, in fact, begin the book with the libel trial, and specifically, as you said, against the librarian, a Mr. Garnett. You use the trial to introduce us to Victoria Woodhull, and you use Mr. Garnett throughout the book as a way to, in a way, comment on the unfolding narrative.
Uh-huh. That's true. That's true. All of that is true.
Tell us why you chose that, because I think it's a particularly effective mechanism.
Well, yes. So thank you for that. You know, frankly, I didn't want to start in the kind of customary way where, you know, you begin to explain somebody at the point at which they were born and then move it forward chronologically. And so I am always of the mind that it's better to show than to tell in a narrative, regardless of whether or not it's, you know, nonfiction. And so actually the dialogue was taken from the transcript. And the idea that a woman with no formal education, an American who obviously had just, you know, relatively recently arrived in London, had the gumption and the tenacity to sue the British Museum, which in fact was part of the government. I mean, the British Museum is a trust, so to speak, of the government. And so it was the most audacious, even the idea was quite remarkable. And she was so articulate and so fierce, frankly, and kind of relentlessly logical in the manner in which she not only defended herself, but accused this institution of libel, that I thought that would be the most compelling way to introduce her in every aspect of who she was. And then I deliberately set it against the head librarian, who was kind of quintessentially English in that, you know, kind of very reserved, understated. He was absolutely brilliant, but very quiet and devoted to, you know, his position there and, you know, had never been to America, thought of it as a kind of bizarre, anything's possible country. And he, along with us and me, quite honestly, because I must always write books about subjects I don't necessarily understand or certainly don't know a great deal about. And so he became almost my company and made himself available to the reader in exploring who this woman was.
And Victoria shocks the representative of the British Museum or of the Crown, sir, now I've forgotten his name, you can supply it.
Yes, Charles Russell.
That's right, Sir Charles Russell. He's defending the British Museum, and she shocks him because, well, what is the notion of women during that time, and why does she shock him so much?
Well, she shocks him in any number of ways. You know, this is a man who was the Attorney General. And as I said, you know, the museum continues to be an extension, so to speak, of the government, of the British everything, its culture. And so as a trustee, he was defending the institution and other trustees. And he was known to be absolutely brilliant and very, you know, relentlessly logical and the most kind of acute formidable cross-examiner in any UK court. And so he was understandably, you know, confident in his ability. And so he came up against somebody who, in ways that he could not have imagined, possessed the same characteristics, you know, intellectual character. She had total recall. She was utterly logical. And of course, he completely underestimated her because she was a woman and because she had no education and because she was an American. And, you know, to frame this in perspective, regardless of where you were as a woman, whether it was America or England or anywhere else for that matter, you had no legal recourse. You had no agency. If you earned, you know, on the rare occasion you were earning money, it would go to your father or your husband. Women in marriages couldn't get divorced. And so, you know, she was a total anomaly. And as a result, a great surprise, obviously, to somebody like Sir Charles.
Now, what really does unfold, you know, in the beginning, we get a picture of Victoria Woodhull as this brilliant woman that you just described. Later on, the portrait becomes, you know, considerably more nuanced, let's say. Tell us now about her family. I mean, she's a real rags to riches story.
She not only was she rags to riches, but she was rags to riches on three separate occasions during the course of her 90-year life. But again, to put this in perspective, you know, she came from a profoundly poor set of circumstances. There was absolutely no money. You know, her father was a con man. The mother was illiterate and a religious zealot who was, you know, mentally ill. There were, I think, seven, you know, there were two deaths, you know, in terms of childbirth, but they were left with seven children. So she was not the eldest, but the second eldest. She had no education. And by that, I really am, you know, very literal about it. She taught herself to read, and she was obviously brilliant. She did have total recall, and she was also acutely, you know, she was very, very much an observer, and she believed in herself. She insisted that at the age of four, by the way, at the latest 5 years old, she insisted that she had a spirit guide who had appeared in front of her and predicted that she would become wealthy within a city surrounded with ships on the water, and that she would be a leader of people. And so whether or not she actually had a vision, you know, it's difficult to know, but it could very well be that this was her way of escaping a dismal childhood where, you know, there was physical and emotional abuse. She was identified as possibly the only real earner in the family, because this was a period of time where, most especially after the Civil War, when there were so many people who died and, you know, so many left behind to grieve without being able to even identify their, you know, their loved ones, because almost always was the case that without the ability to identify the deceased, you know, they were buried without identity. And in fact, many times you didn't know whether somebody was actually coming home. And so the more institutional religions were failing, you know, in that regard. There was no solace to be found. And spiritualism kind of bubbled up to the surface. And this was also the result of this incredible period of change where there was, for the first time, you know, electricity. There was the idea that you could send messages through the air in terms of, you know, telegraphs. So there was a belief that if you could do all of these things, then you could also speak to the dead, but in a very life-affirming way. And so that then afforded the opportunity for various people to claim to be clairvoyants, who could speak to the dead. And what became hugely popular were child clairvoyants. And so Victoria, at a very young age, was supporting the family doing just that. They were kind of operating out of an open wagon or a closed wagon, depending upon, you know, the weather. And they moved from, you know, small town to small town. And she, you know, was charging a fee. They were also selling elixir, you know, which fundamentally was, I don't know, vegetable oil laced with alcohol. So she had the most dismal, depressing, you know, poverty-ridden childhood. And she escaped, her father especially was abusive, so she escaped by marrying herself when she was just 14, and she married a man who was just hopeless, and she ended up, you know, taking charge of him. She was this forceful personality who was, you know, well, I suppose more a force of nature than anything else.
And she was accompanied in this by one of her sisters, Tenny. We should mention that both of them were extraordinarily beautiful, and they used that beauty. You know, there's a real portrait here of a woman who knows how to manipulate circumstances to her favor. How do you think her abusive childhood shaped her both for ill and for good?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think that she survived it. I mean, obviously, she was determined to survive her childhood, and she was very astute. So she was not, you know, she had been exposed to any number of ways to connive and outwit reality, so to speak, and manipulate. It is true. She was beautiful. Her younger sister was even more beautiful, but very kind of, I wouldn't say frivolous, but, you know, was less serious. And so they kind of clung to one another and became almost in a very kind of symbiotic relationship. They survived it all. And, you know, what was difficult for me as somebody who was trying to remain as objective as possible and responsible in terms of my research was that there was always a challenge because Victoria was somebody who were all the things that I've just described, but she was also a self-invention. So, you know, she had, you know, wrote journals and she began to give lectures and so on. And she presented herself in a way that wasn't entirely accurate. And, you know, there was always the kind of massaging of reality. I think that more than anything else, she believed in herself. She was an early feminist, but she was also a sexual opportunist. And by the way, one doesn't preclude the other, certainly not in her case. And all of this said, what I admire and what must be remembered is that she was at the forefront of some of the most progressive political ideals. And so she made her way to New York, where she, whether or not it was deliberate or happenstance, she met Cornelia Vanderbilt, who was the richest man in America, who was a spiritualist himself. She convinced him that she would work with him in order to contact deceased investors, you know, who had stock tips. And at the same time, she made available her younger sister, who clearly became his mistress. And keep in mind, he was in his 70s. And, you know, these two young women were fundamentally, one was still probably in her teens, Tenny, and Victoria must have been in her mid-20s at the time. And Victoria was so astute in terms of watching how Vanderbilt played the market. And keep in mind, she, as a woman, she was not allowed to trade in stocks, but she learned and watched. And so she would send men in, you know, to do her bidding, which was something that she did quite often, quite, you know, in every conceivable sense. And during Black Friday, which is when the value of gold plummeted and took with it the value of stocks, she bought stocks at the bottom of the barrel, so to speak, knowing that eventually the market would correct itself. And indeed it did. And she became herself extremely rich. And rather than simply stepping back and enjoying herself, she launched a brokerage firm on Wall Street, which was unheard of. And, you know, again, she had no access to the market, and she made money doing that. So
a brokerage firm for women.
Yes, she recognized that women, it was fascinating, there was a kind of delicious irony in all of this, because the women who actually made money and could keep it were the madams of the brothels. And, you know, this was during the Gilded Age in New York, and there were very expensive, high-class, you know, luxurious brothels. And, you know, it was kind of given that the most especially the wealthy men were frequenting these brothels. And so fundamentally what was happening were the young women were, you know, had picked up stock tips and then conveyed them to the madam, who then would go off to Victoria Woodhill's brokerage firm and convert it to their own ownership of stock. So it was the most kind of wonderfully delicious irony, where they were making money from information from the men that women overheard and then converted it into their own wealth. But, you know, there was a separate entrance to the brokerage house for women, and she became so well known that people would come visit her, you know, just to understand what in God's name was going on here. So Walt Whitman came to see, you know, introduce himself and to see what she was all about. Susan Anthony, you know, who at the time was the kind of old guard of the suffragette movement. Mark Twain had heard about her. So she became quite well known. And then she became rather notorious, because I think that often is the case that, you know, what goes after the pride is the hubris that then, you know, moves you into a big fall off, you know, your platform. And I think that's precisely what happened. So she came up against, she started a newspaper because she wanted to run for president, even though she couldn't vote.
And she was too young.
She was too young. Yeah, she had to be 35. I mean, it was unfathomable in every conceivable sense. But she felt that, you know, she had made money, and she did so in a city on water surrounded, you know, with ships. In other words, New York. According to her spirit guide, she would become also a leader of people. And she felt that in order to do this, she would run for president. She would then, in order to enable that, she would launch a newspaper. And it was a weekly newspaper. And that is when she stepped forward with all of these incredibly astute political proposals that are just unheard of at the time.
And tell us what some of them were, because I was quite surprised too. I mean, I knew that she had advocated free love, whatever that means. But she advocated a lot more than that as well,
yes.
Things that we still have not achieved.
Yes, of course, we're still grappling with well, you know, again, to put the idea of the free love as it was conceived within that era at that time, it's not the hedonistic sense of multiple partners and promiscuity that one would think. It had to do with the freedom of a woman to choose, the freedom of the woman to enjoy sexual relationships without the fear of getting pregnant. So there was that. There was the idea of, obviously, a birth control. You know, at the time, there were not many options, but there was a way where you would lessen the probability of getting pregnant. And there was most especially the idea that a woman, most especially in an abusive marriage, had the right to be divorced and then had the right to earn a living. And just again, to reference the time, it was a period of time in America and also England, by the way, because America fundamentally absorbed, you know, the common law tenets that were practiced in Great Britain, that if you were married, if you were the man married, you could beat your wife as long as you were using something that was no thicker than your little finger. And if you made money, it was not yours. So it was one of these hideous situations where you just can't win for losing. In other words, you couldn't get divorced even if you were abused. And then if you were left on your own, you couldn't earn money unless you became a prostitute or a madam. So that was what encompassed the concept at the time of free love, was the opportunity to somehow address those issues and ideally correct them. But, you know, when you move into the more broadly based initiatives, she was endorsing the idea of an 8-hour workday. She was proposing unions. She was also proposing a one-term presidency. She proposed a national health care system. And in a way that is just so far out there, she also proposed the idea of an international court of appeal that would deal with trade issues and civil rights and so on and so forth. So she was, you know, she was so forward-thinking.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Eden Collinsworth about her biography, The Improbable Victoria Woodhull. Now, this brought her all to the attention of, until Stephen Miller, one of the most odious and evil.
Yeah, no, I know. He was such a piece of work. Anthony Comstock. There are Comstock laws as a result of his. He was very dangerous and had free rein. And so he appeared kind of out of nowhere. So this was a man who, you know, believed that God had, you know, put him on the earth to ferret out evil and pornography. And he was somebody who I think was earning a modest income in after the Civil War in New York, but at his own, you know, prompting, would visit the bookstores. He was especially suspicious of any literature. And he would identify for the police what he believed to be pornography, and they would then shut down the store. And he realized that, in fact, in order to establish more of a footing where he had more power, he volunteered to go without a salary and become involved on a federal level with the Postal Service. And so that gave him then the platform or the wherewithal to identify pornography that had crossed the state, the various state lines. And he had his eye on Victoria because she was so progressive. But he deliberately orchestrated a situation where somebody in another state, whether it was Connecticut or New Jersey, purchased a copy of her weekly. It had to be mailed. It crossed the state line. He then swept in and not only accused her, but then, you know, had her incarcerated, you know, during her trial of sending pornography across the state line. And she, you know, was put in a very drafty, damp jail in New York City. She had respiratory ailments as a result. So when she finally got out, she, you know, had lost virtually everything. So here yet again, so she went from poverty to riches, and then she moved into poverty again, because when she got out of prison, her newspaper had folded, her brokerage house had folded, and she had no way of earning a living as a lecturer, which at one point was very lucrative for her. And so she just was completely bereft. And then, in a way that you could not make up in fiction, the Vanderbilt family decided, because Cornelius was on his deathbed and they were anxious that Victoria and her sister would try to blackmail the family, because they knew a great deal about everything, including his sexual proclivities. And so they offered Victoria and Tenney $200,000, which was a great deal of money at the time, with the pledge that they leave the country and never return. And that is how she ended up in London.
Yeah, incredible story. I want to point out to our listeners that the Comstock Law is still on the books. And many people fear that it will be used by the MAGA regime to prohibit the mailing of contraceptives, and thereby take away by fiat the right to abortion on a national level.
All of that is true. And who among us would have guessed or could have imagined a situation where we, how many decades later, would be facing these challenges? And he also, I mean, there's so many similarities in that, like Elon Musk, he didn't accept any salary and was given this incredible reach in terms of authority and power, very much along the lines of what has happened today in terms of politics. He had the support of, you know, various extreme religious factions, and that's what propelled him ahead. And then he kind of outwitted Congress in ways that, you know, even they realized after the fact was ludicrous, because he went after everything. I mean, he went after not only the Arts Students League in New York because they were painting from nude models, but he went after plays, including when George Bernard Shaw brought a play to New York, he went after that. I mean, the only person who benefited and was delighted by it actually was Walt Whitman, because he went after Leaves of Grass, and because there was so much curiosity, for the first time, Whitman started to get regular royalty checks off that book. So he was the only one who managed to benefit. But it was a very, very alarming set of circumstances. And here we are, you know, over 50 years later.
Now, we haven't really talked about her role in the suffragette movement. It was a kind of contradictory one. Talk to us about that. I think we can safely say she did a fair amount of self-sabotage, but what do you feel was her place in the history of feminism in this country? So talk a little bit about her role there, and then what lessons we can learn, or what role she played in the long term.
Yes. Well, you know, as I said, I'm not entirely sure what she believed in. I think that she had to believe in women's rights because that was the only thing that, you know, she lived by it, so to speak. She forged her own path in ways that were, you know, were simply not available, but she made it happen, as they say. My sense is, as I had said before, she overstepped the mark, as the English would say. In other words, it was very difficult for her to moderate herself. And so if she had just remained focused on one thing or a few things in particular and remained measured, she would have been far more impactful. And it became very clear to the old guard within the movement, the suffragette movement, that Victoria was fundamentally using that platform in order to increase her audience. That said, she did breathe new life into the movement. She was the first woman who appealed directly to a congressional committee, promoting the idea of the women's right to vote. She was incredibly valuable to the movement in that way. But she lived such a kind of controversial and, you know, it could be said louche lifestyle, that those people on the front line, so to speak, of the movement decided she was just more trouble than she was worth. And in fact, you know, when there were books that were written about by, you know, the leaders of the movement about the movement itself, Victoria was not even mentioned really. You know, she was just expunged. She wasn't even in the index. I agree with you. She was her own worst enemy. In you know, there are many instances where that is certainly the case. Whether or not she ever acknowledged that, I somehow doubt it, because she continued to repeat herself, or those parts of her persona would, you know, bubble right back up to the surface.
Well, it is just a fascinating read. I loved it. The Improbable Mrs. Woodhull. And this has just been great to talk with you, Eden Collinsworth, about the book. And I understand that you are working on a biography of Edith Wharton, and I hope at some point we get to talk with you about that as well.
Oh, well, thank you so much. I enjoyed myself. Thank you so much for it all.
And you can find links to read or listen to a sample from The Improbable Victoria Woodhull at writersvoice.net. Next up, we move forward just a few years to talk about a novel that also features women in battle with the odious Anthony Comstock. Stay tuned after the break.
Bring the good old bugle, boys, we'll sing another song. Sing it with a spirit that shall start the cause along. Sing it as we ought to sing it, cheerily and strong. Giving the ballad to the mothers. Hurrah, hurrah, we bring the jubilee. Hurrah, hurrah, the homes they shall be free. So we'll sing the chorus from the mountains to the sea, giving the ballad to the mothers.
That was Give the Ballad to the Mothers, sung by Elizabeth Knight. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to listen again, like, and subscribe to the podcast. Today, we're talking about a pivotal era in women's history in the U.S., the decades that spanned the battle to win the franchise for women and the first battle for reproductive rights. Unfortunately, a battle we're still waging today, a century later. In her novel, The Sisters of Book Row, best-selling writer Shelley Noble recreates a vanished literary world, Manhattan's famous Book Row, a stretch of Fourth Avenue that once housed dozens of rare and secondhand bookstores. It's 1915 when Anthony Comstock's anti-obscenity crusade used federal law to seize and destroy books about women's health. Noble's novel follows three sisters who inherit their father's bookstore and struggle to keep the shop alive amid increasing censorship. The novel also touches on the underground circulation of information about women's health during the Comstock era, connecting the story of censorship with the emerging fight for reproductive rights. Through the lives of ordinary people, booksellers, printers, and activists, The Sisters of Book Row shows how cultural change often begins with individuals, in this case women, resisting authority. Let's listen to my conversation with Shelley Noble. Shelley Noble, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you for having me today.
Your novel, The Sisters of Book Row, is set in 1915 in New York during Anthony Comstock's campaign against so-called obscene material, books, art, even information about women's health. Any of these could be seized or destroyed. What first drew you to this moment in history?
Well, as an author, you're always keeping your antennae out for something interesting. And my thing as an author is to find those little niches of people who actually make history that we should know about, but we very often don't know about, because I feel like just everybody makes history. We make the fabric of history where all the big, fascinating, famous things are done. But there are people that their everyday lives affect how our futures are. So I was looking, my editor said, why don't you write something about books? So I started looking around, and I remember I spent many, many years living in New York. So, you know, I remembered vaguely there was a place called Book Row, but it's been gone for years because we always like build new. And it was Fourth Avenue between Union Square, which has always been the beginning place for all protests. Also, it's wonderful to stroll through and eat hot chestnuts in the winter. And then the four blocks below that to Astor Place, which is the home of Cooper Union, which was the first free university, I think, in the States. So I just started picking around and looking for general information about Book Row, and I thought, what a great idea. And then I was thinking about how could I could move this place into an event that would start the story off. And a friend and I were like pouring through, I think we just went to something like Wikipedia year by year. And I knew I had been writing about early 1900s, but I had stopped around 1907. I thought, let me go a little further, but stop before the First World War, because then the world becomes a completely different place. So we were looking at things, and then suddenly we came across this just out of the blue, that there was a huge robbery of ancient manuscripts that they found, like in a dig, in an archaeological dig. In 1914, there was a huge discovery of papyri, some of which had fragments of the poetry of the classical poetess Sappho, who had been banned for centuries. So I went, that would be interesting, because what if they found it and then someone stole it? So there I had two pieces. And so the pieces just kept adding to themselves. I was scrolling through Google one day and found an article about three contemporary sisters of ours, the Cohen sisters, who they inherited the Argosy bookstore, which is very famous in New York, from their father. And it was this nice article about how they ran the store and the different interests that the three girls had. And that made me think, what would three sisters who own a store now do when confronted with Anthony Comstock, stolen manuscripts. And as it so happened, it just worked out that in 1915, Comstock was about to arrest Margaret Sanger for the fourth time for disseminating women's health information. And she would go to jail for 45 years. So she flees the country. And there I had all these pieces. It sounds really crazy, right? They're all spread out. There's a little of this, a little of that. It's kind of like making a stew. You add ingredients. And then I suddenly had my story. And I confess I have a personal vendetta against Anthony Comstock. The first time I read about him in history, I thought, what a horrible, horrible man. So it was good I finally got to put him in a story. And he just so happens, coincidentally, to have died in October of 1915. So I knew it was a perfect book.
Well, that's great. And we're not going to talk about the stolen manuscript because that kind of is part of the mystery line of this book. But I do want to pick up on Anthony Comstock. The Comstock laws treated information about birth control, of course, as obscene. From your research, how broadly were his laws applied, and how much discretion did Comstock actually have?
All the discretion in the world. It was, even now, the book is out, and I've been going talking to lots of different groups. People actually don't, they kind of recognize the name, but they still, even today, with all the things that have been happening in Texas and the Dodd decision against Roe v. Wade, people still aren't familiar with him. So he came out of the Civil War, right, in the 1870s and went to New York, moved there, and he was hired by the Society for the Suppression of Vice, which was put together by these conservative, really rich men. And then he was also hired by the U.S. Post Office to keep pornography from being sent through the mail. Now, that doesn't sound too evil on the surface, but he was a fanatic. He was a zealot, and I think it's pretty much agreed among scholars that he hated women. So he went completely out of control. He was given the ability to, or legality to, enter a place, search it, seize, arrest, and fine. And he was given 50% of all fines. So that was certainly incentive, if he didn't have incentive enough as it is. So he mainly went out after brothels and abortionists and sending any women's health through the mail or attempting to sell it on the street or in a store. But you never knew what he was going to make ban from one week to the next. One week he would come into the bookstores, and he was always attacking the bookstores when he didn't have enough brothels in his schedule. So he would go on these war paths, and he'd come through the bookstores, and especially Fourth Avenue, where all the rare books and the used books were sold, and just confiscate book after book after book. And then some books he wouldn't take because they were fine, but then you didn't know whether the next week those would be in his mind. He was said to have burned over 150,000 books, and he confiscated 5 tons of books. I don't know how much of that's true. It sounds like an inordinate amount of books. He thought, beyond the brothels and beyond prostitution and the pornography and the dirty pictures, he thought books, above all, were the road to prostitution. And he attacked them with fervor that was just not believable.
And you know, when we talk about censorship historically, we often focus on the laws or the politics of it. But for the people living through it, the people that you portray in this book, Shelley Noble, in this novel, The Sisters of Book Row, the impact must have felt very personal. The booksellers, the readers, the writers. As you were writing this novel, what did you feel was the emotional cost of censorship for ordinary people?
It was huge, even for people who didn't read. It permeated the atmosphere. Now, by 1915, the interesting thing here is society did turn on him, but through his own stupidity. He became so outrageous that by 1950, when the book takes place, he was a laughingstock. The post office fired him. He refused to leave. He had a band of thugs that went around with him and just creating havoc. You know, you could be a perfectly legitimate store, a stationery store. They would come in and knock everything to the ground and stomp all over them and just walk out. There was nothing you could do. So no one ever felt particularly safe. If you sold books, you know, especially if you needed help with your health or if you were looking for an abortion, so whatever people feel about it, he got rid of all the trained people, the trained abortionists, but he didn't go after those back alley folks that he should have gone after. But by now he is outcast, he's laughed at. I usually try to do as much primary source material as I can. And by now, the judges are like, we're going, oh, no, not Comstock again. Mr. Comstock, please sit down. And the newspapers did horrible cartoons about him. And the more they made fun of him, the more outrageous he got. The post office couldn't stop him. The Society for the Suppression of Vice couldn't stop him. And he finally, by being so overwhelmed, Margaret Sanger had to flee the country and left behind her an unpublished manuscript called Family Limitations. She left it with her husband, and he spent a whole half a year looking for these people that might have the manuscript. And he made himself sick, and he finally died of pneumonia because of it. But everybody was, because you didn't know. You didn't know if he would just come up to people walking on the street and snatch a package out of your hand. It could be a dress or, you know, anything.
It's interesting. He was a laughingstock when he died. But 100 years later, he's a threat again because I have heard talk that the Comstock Law, which is still on the books, could be used to ban abortion medication.
Absolutely. And this is why it's so important to know these things. His laws, the federal laws, were zombied out. Roe v. Wade pretty much killed it. But in the meantime, states had adopted them along the way, had adopted their own version of the Comstock Law because it was easier to deal with it locally. But when the Dodd decision was made, it killed, it took the legs out of Roe v. Wade. People had already been using the Comstock Law, which was still on the books but zombied out, to do the things in Texas and keeping mifepristone from going through the being mailed from state to state. The same people who, like, you heard terrible stories of, you know, someone with an ectopic pregnancy was, like, in such pain, and the hospital would turn her away to sit in the parking lot until she was close to death, and then they'd be able to do her as an emergency. And it just spread and spread. And these women that go around the country banning books everywhere, just they've never read them, and they're using the Comstock Law to validate it. And since it's still on the books, what do you do?
And we are talking with Shelley Noble about her new novel, The Sisters of Book Row. And now let's turn to those sisters. Tell us about your three protagonists, Celia, Daphne, and Olivia, the three sisters who own the bookshop in question, the Arcadia Bookshop. Let's start with Celia.
Well, these three girls grew up above the bookshop. Their father owned it. Their mother died of having too many children because he wanted a male heir. And so the sisters take over. Their mother died. So Olivia, the oldest, took over the family and the shop. Celia is the youngest, and she was around to see more of what her mother went through, having one child after another, after another, after another, and never gaining her strength so that she could carry a healthy infant. And so she stumbled by chance across a member of Margaret Sanger's coterie and went to a meeting one day and said that this is right. Women should be able to take care of themselves and eat healthily and know how to take care of their children and only have enough children that they want and not always be in recovery mode. But she can't tell anybody. She starts working for the movement. but she can't tell her sisters because it's highly illegal right here in New York City. So she has to sneak around, and she knows that if she's caught, that her whole family will be in trouble with the law. But it's something that she has a fire in her soul to make sure that women have a voice in about how they use their bodies.
And Daphne is a little bit apart from her other sisters, and yet she really also plays an important role in this book.
She does. Daphne is the middle sister, and middle children, I've been told, I'm an only, sort of get batted back and forth and become their own person in spite of it. Daphne is a dreamer in another way, not the dreaming for, you know, equal rights for women, but she just wants to find that Mr. Darcy, that perfect man, and have a cottage with a picket fence and children. You know, she's one of those, she lives in books, and she only reads books with happy endings. And it's interesting because she makes quite a transformation from the beginning of the book to the end. And like maybe being the middle character, I kind of gave her short shrift at first because I was, the other two had more interesting storylines to me personally. So by the time I realized that I had just sort of put her in all these places that she could have been doing things, I had to go back and say, okay, Daphne, you get equal time here. So I spent some time with her. It was quite nice.
And then Olivia actually is the one who is most involved with the stolen ancient volume. Tell us a little bit about her.
Well, Olivia's the oldest. She's the heir apparent. She was trying to be the son that her father wanted, but never got, even though he made his wife try again and again and again. She feels like she has to be the patriarch, take care of the girls, take care of the store, make it a success, do all the things that a son would have done. And she had gone to college, and she even had a short-lived time at working at the Metropolitan, restoring old manuscripts. But then the mother died, so she had to give that up to take care of the girls, and then the father died, and then she was in charge of the whole thing. And she lives for books, and she lives for restoring old volumes and for discovering things that no one else has seen. And this mysterious manuscript that shows up one day, she doesn't want to let it go. Daphne's like, just put it back, just throw it out the door, pretend like we've never seen it. And Celia's like, you know, she's, I've got enough troubles as it is. We really must do something, call the museums, have someone take this off our hands, because if Comstock got any kind of news of it, we'd all go to jail, and he would destroy it. And it's classic literature. They all love each other and are loyal to each other, but they're just so off on different paths that they must keep secret because they don't want to hurt the others, or they don't want to put the others in harm's way.
Talking about secrets, Celia's secret work, distributing information about women's health, points to a whole underground network of knowledge sharing among women in that time. In your research, what did you learn about how women actually did circulate information that society tried to suppress?
Well, it was quite remarkable. And, well, first of all, there was what coincided with the settlement movement, and that was where educated, well-off people went to live within the settlement, and their place of living became sort of the community center. So people who lived in the tenements could come there to learn, you know, health, how to wash your baby, because some children were having children, and English and writing and all sorts of things. So they became a part of the community. And those kind of ties give it a group of people an opening for, I don't want to say underground, though it was kind of an underground, it had to be an underground movement. Celia gets messages stuck inside of a cookbook, say, to where she can take the next, she does printing on this for the movement, like a list of vitamins, prenatal vitamins, or birth control information. It was extremely dangerous because, first of all, most of the facilities in jails didn't have really places for women. They would have one holding pen for everybody. no matter whether you were sick or, you know, diseased or broken or violent, or you just got caught by mistake, which happened a lot, especially with Comstock around. You got put in one room, dirty room, whereas there were not separate cells, but smaller cells for the number of men. So everything had to be on the sly. They were like, you know, secret pockets and skirts that they could roll up canisters to be printed. They put finished papers on health. They would put them inside patterns. The pattern makers would make down at their place, so somebody would have to take them down there and, you know, hide them so somebody else would get them and sneak them into the pattern makers. And when they would put them, slide them in with the patterns, which was really frightful, because if somebody that was totally against family planning found them, they would trace them back to the pattern makers. So it had to be done very quietly and underground, which just doesn't seem right in 1915. That's a little over 100 years ago. We think we're more civilized than that, but I guess it hasn't changed much.
Your story actually takes place just a few years before women gained the right to vote nationally.
About 6 years.
Yeah. So talk about the links between the women's suffrage movement, the movement to provide family planning, and also the labor movement.
This was that period. And it came all from a group, well, not all from a group, but if you were living in New York and the other centers of the country, the class lines are being blurred more than before. Back in the Victorian era, there was a place for everyone. Everyone knew their place. But then there was this huge revolution of discoveries of different kind of, you know, like the bicycle. The bicycle was a huge thing in women's freedoms because they didn't have to wait for Papa's carriage anymore. Those kind of little things really fascinate me, because who would have thought, right? So the labor movement, which is largely, you think of guys striking and miners and all those things, but people like the Colony Club, which I had, my last book was about, was created a little earlier than this, and they were very instrumental in changing the child labor laws. And they went out and picketed the rich ladies in their furs and hats. They were known as the Mink Brigade. And at the same time, Margaret Sanger was doing her work. And even though the classes weren't really mixing that much socially, they found a common place in those movements. And it was because women had been fomenting right below the surface of having true power. It was just a few years before that. I mean, Olivia had gone to college because her father sent her, because he needed somebody to do the restoration of the books. There were other women who finally were saying, why can't I go to college? Why can't I have a career? It hadn't been that long ago that women couldn't even have their own bank accounts. They couldn't even go to lunch together unless they had a man accompanying them. Now, this was just 10 years before this book in 1915. So suddenly, there's a burst of energy from all these women who've been, you know, these people have been working on labor laws. These other people have been working on pasteurizing milk. You know, they could, people would add chalk to milk to sell it so it looked white, so it was still good, and it was terrible milk. There was so much going on, and there were so many little diverse groups that was all just burgeoning and burgeoning and burgeoning. And finally, we move into that progressive period that it all sort of comes to a head at once.
Well, your book was hugely enjoyable to read. Shelley Noble, it's just been delightful to talk with you about the Sisters of Book Row. It was just as much a delight to read it.
Oh, thank you so much.
Shelley Noble is the New York Times and USA Today best-selling author of Whisper Beach, Beach Colors, and The Tiffany Girls. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to an audio sample from the Sisters of Book Row. And don't forget, when you subscribe to the Writer's Voice podcast, give us a 5-star rating. It really helps other listeners to find the show. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.